Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 446th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today, to continue our COVID theme and the COVID tools for practice that we're developing, we'll pull in some of the peer team members from Edmonton who have been busy getting two done. We'll start with Mike, because I think Mike's going to lead the talk on this one, and then also introduce Tina. But Mike Kay, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Mike Colbert, thanks for having me. I'm a professor at the Department of Family Medicine in the University of Alberta, here in about 2 feet of snow in Edmonton, and happy to introduce my co-author on these. And Tina and I have done a few of these COVID tools. So Tina, you want to tell us a bit about you?
Yeah, awesome. Good afternoon. My name is Tina Koronik. I am associate professor at the University of Alberta and work in the peer team with all of these guys.
And this is the first time in 446 episodes that we've had, I think, four people in different locations. And you have to love COVID for that. So hopefully the sound quality will be acceptable. We'll tweak it as much as possible, but we can't promise anything. But we're going to talk about... We've done a little bit of stuff on COVID, but we're going to talk about what does it look like when you see someone? So what are the presenting symptoms, the clinical course, and the risk factors for mortality? And you guys did a really good, thorough review of this. So why don't you guys start off?
Sure, I'll start off if that's okay. Yeah. So yeah. I think before we jump into the clinical context, I think it's super important to just realize where we're getting the information from. As most of your readers or listeners are aware, that this first started in China. And so we have the most data in China, but some of the data coming out of China, sometimes tricky to interpret. And then it kind of moved through Europe. And so the next emerging evidence is Italy, and then North America is coming our way. And I don't know about you guys, when I first read this and certain areas are getting this mortality rate and this mortality rate, and there's huge differences, you know, on face value, you start thinking, man, one country or one jurisdiction is doing way better than the other. And then, wait a minute, there must be something else. So I think it's really important to note that out of all these cases that we've had in the world, so I think we're crossing 2 million now and probably 150,000 deaths coming soon. The number of cases, the proportion of cases, the proportion of people that die, all of this stuff is really, really depends on the healthcare in the jurisdictions, whether people have access to testing, whether people are hospitalized, they have barriers to hospitalization, they're easy to get to hospital, and there's real differences. I was trying to figure out what's the difference with Italy and maybe an initial place like Germany that didn't seem to have many case fatality rates. And I think that just keeping it simple is that when you test everybody in your or as many people as you can, your case fatality rate is going to be low. And if you limit your testing to those very sick and or dying, your case fatality rate may be higher. And I think that's just really important before we get into the signs and symptoms, before we look at face value and say one jurisdiction is doing so much better in keeping people alive or not. It's all about the denominator and how many cases you really have depends on your testing. Does that make sense to you guys?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt.
Absolutely.
And that's the tricky part about and why almost no one can be that confident in a lot of this stuff, because there's so many assumptions that are being made. In particular about the denominator, which can vary depending on the testing and all that sort of stuff. So at best, we're going to give you the best estimate we can come up with. But boy, it is at best tricky.
Yeah, you bet. And probably as we go further along into this and as testing becomes a little more unified, we may settle out at some type of rate, 2-3%, somewhere in there. But right now, you know that we have over 10. And previously there was under 1. And I think as we go further out, we'll get a little more uniform. All right. So with that aside, and that's a bit of caveat, our initial information came out of China. And probably the best review of what the presenting signs and symptoms were probably from a case study of about just over 1,000 hospitalized or outpatient cases, in China. They really didn't tell us what proportion of these cases were hospitalized or outpatients. That being said, probably what the, your readers have or listeners have heard is cough and fever were the most presenting common symptoms. That's evolved a little bit with the North American data to also now put shortness of breath in there. And in this Chinese cohort, about half of them had fever on presentation, but about 90% during hospitalization. So cough and fever were common presenting symptoms. I was hopeful when I first started this that we'd be able to say, almost like what's the flu and what's a common cold? This is COVID. This is influenza. This is a common cold, and have discerning features and symptoms. And unfortunately, it really does not discern. There's so much overlap between the common cold, influenza, and COVID that we really can't say this is going to be this and this is going to be this. There are some atypical symptoms, whether it be gastrointestinal, they've been reported. Loss of smell has been reported, although we really have a hard time giving a proportion of those. Sore throat, some other atypical symptoms have also been reported. And again, there's so much overlap with our other known viral infections. So those are presenting signs and symptoms. And then when you're seeing them maybe in your eMERGE or rural eMERGE or your hospital, I think one of the key features in laboratory tests is this lymphopenia. So we're seeing that both in China, again, from that same Chinese cohort, but also in North American data, and especially if the sicker patients are having a lymphopenia, probably about 80%, which is important. Patients would then progress probably to have an investigation like a chest x-ray, and probably about 60% or more would have chest x-ray abnormalities, often either local or bilateral shadows. And then if they're going to go on to have a CT scan, we're seeing this classic ground glass appearance on CT scan. And they're actually using that as almost gold standard for who does and who doesn't have COVID in some of these cases. So that's kind of the best evidence that we had from the largest cohort of initial patients coming out of China.
But sort of help with you guys, like you guys are still seeing patients, or at least some of you are, like, what are you guys doing in any way, shape, or form to differentiate anything? Or are you just saying it's just basically based on the severity of, or just basically how ill they are?
I can comment on what happens in Peace River is that we are trying to keep one area kind of clean. So our clinic trying to be clean and send the other ones to eMERGE. That being said, anybody with these type of symptoms, we're just swabbing. I don't know if that's happening in your jurisdiction, Tina.
So a little bit different in Edmonton, and the process has changed over time. It is a good question, though, because even amongst all this data flowing in, there's a lot of gray areas. And that idea, if patients call in with symptoms, for a while, the standard response was, well, yeah, you may have it. You just stay home and self-isolate. And, you know, we weren't testing, and then we were testing. And so that's varied a little bit as well. What I think is a really interesting question that my husband posed to me is like, well, if you're self-isolating, when do you go to eMERGE? At what point do you say, okay, this is too much for me to actually be assessed? Because we have this really a bit of a gray zone. And I know that some groups have developed different protocols. Although, again, interesting how you would apply this at home. You know, if your SATs are low or if your respirate is high, which might be hard for an individual patient to assess. But I have seen some protocols being developed in that way. But it is really interesting. A lot of this data, the data that Mike was citing, a lot of it comes from patients who are presenting to hospitals. So in the community, and this has been pointed out by other researchers, there's a big hole. We don't have a lot of good evidence on sort of progression in the community and sort of looking at that group, because that hasn't been really a priority at this point. It's been more hospital admissions and then how do they proceed after that. And I thought this wasn't in our tool, but interesting when we looked at some of the data looking around asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic patients and how they slowly developed symptoms. So individual reports of patients who had a fever and then maybe a few days later a fever and maybe a headache. And yeah, how do we, which of those symptoms are attributed to COVID versus those are just, that would have happened regardless.
Like, are you sort of doing the Mike Allen approach that if it's making me really nervous, I might say go to eMERGE?
Well, that's like, my husband was really pressing me, like, well, when do I go? And he's like, do I need a SAT machine? And I said, I don't know. If you, yeah, right. It's a good question.
I think we have to have a low tolerance for that, because there is nothing, as we reviewed last time on the podcast, James, there's nothing definitive that you can say and rest your hat on. You can't say that, well, this person has a rest rate over 20. This person has an increased heart rate. This person has what have you, you know, and there's no constellation of symptoms that can make this diagnosis clinically.
No.
You know, you have a cough and a sore throat. Well, that could easily be COVID.
Yeah.
So, in particularly in younger populations. So I think we have to accept that this respiratory infection, mostly respiratory infection, mimics a lot of our others. And we just have to have a high threshold, for it being, COVID, even though we know that the average person with the sniffles in the community doesn't have COVID. They have allergies right now, or they have a common cold, but we have to have that high level of suspicion, to catch cases. And then when people are sick at home, we obviously can't let them linger there too long if they're developing shortness of breath or those kind of more concerning symptoms.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm just trying to think it through as well, just in a sort of a logical approach. So, you know, let's say you've got a person comes in with, like you said, with the sniffles and a sore throat. I mean, I don't think there's no need to test, because it won't change anything that you would do. So I would assume that those people would not just be tested. I'm assuming that, again, it would be based on, you know, if they're pretty sick, it just helps to know whether or not we think it's COVID.
Well, there's arguments for testing those people, James.
Yeah, I know.
And they include informing people that they have COVID so that they know they need 14 days at home. So they know that they might have a deteriorating course that leads them to hospital. All of those things. No one expects to be visiting the hospital with a sore throat or sniffles. But if you have COVID, if you know that, it can change your... And certainly, I can imagine there are people who don't worry too much about minor symptoms and think, oh, I can go back to work. I can go out shopping. I can do that. But if they were actually advised they have COVID.
Yeah.
So there is arguments. I'm not saying that those people, you know, if you were tested and you're not COVID, that somehow changes things. I think we still have to be extraordinarily careful. But I've heard arguments from people about why everyone should be tested. And then it will start to address Mike's concern right from the start, which was, what is the denominator here?
Yeah.
What is the proportion of people? And there was a... Tina might talk about it in the next podcast, but there's that study in Italy where they did test everyone, found a proportion of the population was positive, and ended up the next series of tests they did a week or 2 weeks later, the number of positives had dropped, like new diagnoses had dropped considerably, because those who were identified were quarantined. So there's a lot of arguments back and forth. We don't absolutely know what the right answer is, but I think I heard Mike starting in. So Mike, do you want to just comment on that too?
Yeah, I just to pick up more, Mike, I agree with both identifying the individual, but also trying to just really figure out, like Tina had stated, we really don't know what a community COVID person looks like. So they're, you know, they're a little unwell, but not super sick, maybe not into hospital. And again, that's that whole void of data. Most of the data coming out definitely in the Southeast Asia were related to hospitalized cases. So just on a spectrum bias, the sicker patient. So it probably makes sense to test more often, more people, just to get a better idea. Because most of our evidence on this is going to be in the retroscope, you know, and looking back at the end of all this when the dust settles and just says, okay, you know, this is what we initially thought. This is what really happened. And maybe just to prepare for a next time, but I think there is some sense to really test more often.
Regardless, in a person who, you know, clearly has certainly something more than just a sore throat and a, you know, and maybe a bit of a cough, they should be self-isolating anyway, at least at present, where we are today.
Yes.
So that's the sort of caveat. But yeah, no, I think, I mean, it would be great if we could get all of this data, because it would really answer a lot of questions, but it needs to be collected in a, you know, proper systematic way, which is really tricky. But anyway, why don't we keep going? Go on with a little bit about the clinical course, because we've got sort of the initial presentation, but you've got some stuff on the clinical course as well.
Sure. So, Tina, do you want to go? You want me to go?
You go ahead and I'll jump in.
Sure. Sure, you bet. So, like I'd say, like many diseases, many of our cases are mild, and best evidence comes out of China. Probably 80, again, depending on the denominator, 80% of these cases are mild. They're really, in the review that looked at all these cases, and I believe it was like 70,000 cases in China, they really described mild as non-pneumonia, which I've never heard of before, or mild pneumonia, which I've heard of double walking pneumonia, like, you know, and all that, all these funny things, but I've never heard of mild pneumonia. That's just like a titch of it or a titch of pleurisy. So mild pneumonia. 15% were severe, where they started getting short of breath and tachypneic, or breathing quickly, and their O2 sats were dropping. And then 5% they thought were critical, which is, seems to be a respiratory ARDS related illness. And then once that starts, multi-organ failure and some other things may come down the road. Our best evidence from North America is, and again, it's just evolving and emerging, is that about 10% of the cases are hospitalized. And out of those 10%, about a quarter may require ICU, mainly for ventilatory support. I think most importantly is the time. How does this go? And, you know, you see cases and then you don't see much for what, you know, you say they may go to ICU, and then you see the death rate that pops up 2+ weeks later. And I think the best that we can identify is the symptom onset to being sick, if you're going to get sick, is in this 4 to 7 day range. Some people say 5 day on average. So about 5 day range. And then the illness, again, the illness onset to ICU is only like a few days thereafter. I think that if you're going to present yourself sick, often you're in hospital, and then in hospital in a day or so, it's fair. And obviously there's exceptions, but it may be obvious whether you're going to require ventilatory support. And then they follow them through this, both North American and Southeast Asia or Chinese data, the mean hospital stay, these people are not turning around and leaving in a day or two. The mean stay to survival or death is 2, and one study showed almost up to 3 weeks. So again, they are requiring prolonged ventilatory support to try and get through this. So that's kind of the best we can tell on clinical course at this stage.
So Mike, it sounds like this disease comes on after close to 7 days, and then it takes another 7 before you need to go to hospital. And so that means that, you know, these patients, and this kind of explains a little bit of what you're talking about. The main thing is the denominator, why death rates change. But also, when the disease is first arriving in a country, we get all these cases, but they haven't had a chance to progress to more serious states in the disease. And that's why that may explain why some countries who are further on in the disease course are showing those higher mortality rates versus some that are very early and just starting to have a burst of new cases.
Yes, for sure. And you talked about, you know, how long it takes. So we're probably going to talk about transmission in the next podcast. But you're right. Being in contact or you know, being infected from a source case doesn't happen instantaneously. It may take a number of days. So you're right. A number of days to transmit, a number of days if you're going to become symptomatic, and then the progression of the illness. You're right. And so it's almost like two waves in an ocean. You know, the first wave is all the cases, and the second wave is obviously smaller, but it's that next wave of death. And these do take a couple of weeks to declare themselves, for sure.
Yeah, for serious illness to come and that death, yeah.
The good news is the majority of them will hopefully be mild cases. And I suspect in the next week or two we'll get better data from North America on mild cases. I know we have anecdotal reports just looking at how things evolve. Like Mike said, depending on the number of – we're in weeks, actually, number of weeks since things have taken off in some of the North American jurisdictions. I still think that probably this 80% mild is probably going to hold true, plus or minus a few percentage, but we'll wait to see.
Yeah, I would jump in with that and say that, like that 80% of detected cases are mild. So I suspect that there's a lot, there's more cases that have not been detected. So that number may increase a bit, that we have a lot of mild cases, but there are the few severe and those who progress somewhat rapidly to bad outcomes.
You bet. I think it also depends on your jurisdiction. If you have a whole population, and I think what's coming out of some of the jurisdictions is you have a whole population that don't have access to healthcare, and they may be disproportionately negatively affected. And if you could imagine, if you don't have access to healthcare and you have social determinants of health, negative social determinants of health, you may also have a few on the other side. I agree with you, Tina, the number will probably go up, but you might have a few on the other side that die without any care. And I think,
that's the sort of the
anything else to say on that?
No, I was just going to say,
it's great to be in Canada. I know you're going to cut this out. Thank God we live in Canada. Honest to gosh.
Yeah. No, I don't think we need to cut that out. Canada is a lovely place. And one of the nice things about Canada is it's so big. And I mean, one of the biggest problems in New York is, look, you know, the density of population in a place like New York. I mean, it's perfect for COVID. Whereas in Canada, you know, we can self-isolate a lot easier. But we've talked a little bit about the clinical course, but you guys also looked a little bit at mortality risk factors.
Yes, for sure. So one of them that's coming out in the news, obviously, this was a New England Journal paper in Seattle, probably about 10 days ago. And it was pretty frightening about what happens once it's into a long-term care facility. Obviously, long-term care patients are some of our most comorbid patients, and obviously that's why they get there. But this was pretty incredible. So in one Seattle facility, 101 out of 130 residents were infected. There were also some visitors and some staff affected. And of those patients, I think the hospitalization rate was over 50%, and the mortality rate was about a third. And that's the first real case report that's been published. But as you know, every day in the news, we're getting outbreaks. It first started in Vancouver. And subsequently, we've had them in Calgary, Bob Cajun, and a few other places in Canada. And I think that it is just highlighting that, A, these patients are sick to begin with, and it doesn't take much to get them unwell. B, they're in confined areas. C, how they're actually living might be challenging, whether they're in multiple shared rooms. And I think the other one, and maybe this is a positive thing, is that working in multiple facilities when workers in long-term care facilities are working in multiple facilities, they're actually facilitating the spread between jurisdictions. And unfortunately, it comes back to symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission. And we'll talk about that in the next podcast. But I think a lot of this stuff has to highlight the fact that there's asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission, as I really don't think anybody would show up to work in a long-term care facility if they're clinically unwell. But long-term care residents and themselves, for all these reasons that we've discussed, do unfortunately have a substantial mortality rate, and are probably pushing the mortality numbers in Canada probably beyond what we would anticipate just based on our numbers. Other risk factors, any comments about that?
No, I was just going to say, and there are other risk factors, though, that, I mean, that's sort of probably in the worst case scenario is in a long-term care facility is probably where you're going to have the worst case scenario, but there are other numbers.
You bet. So other ones included age. So in China, they just did dichotomy greater than or equal to 65 and compared those to patients under 65 and found that the death rate was 6 times higher. Obviously, with that comes with comorbidities as well. And the mean number of comorbidities in Italy from the patients that died was about 2.7. And so when they looked at what really constitutes comorbidities, they looked at stuff like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, chronic respiratory disease, hypertension, and that kind of stuff.
And I always love when they throw in, like, cardiovascular disease, I get it. Chronic respiratory disease, hypertension?
Yeah. Some of these ones don't make sense. I agree with you. I wouldn't really consider that a really terrible comorbidity. Yes, yeah. I agree.
Yeah. But I just find it quite interesting that because I've seen that in a lot of the reports, they lump in things like, and hypertension, as if it's this horrifically. Now, it can be associated with things, but I just found it was interesting. I'd have thought maybe, you know, they had cardiovascular disease or rheumatological issues or respiratory for sure, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and renal disease. I think renal disease is also in some of the other ones as well. You bet.
So one other thing that's come out recently out of the States, I don't know if they've just published a couple reports on that severe obesity was also pretty high up there as a risk factor, which is interesting because we haven't seen that reported in the Chinese reports or much of the Italy ones. So just again, a little bit of a progression of our understanding of what puts you at risk.
You bet. Yeah, for sure. And then finally, one paper came out, and I think we're seeing a smittance of it, but not really a formalized either cohort study or looking at this was cardiac injury. So in China, the patients that presented with COVID-like symptoms, shortness of breath, fever, and also had significantly elevated troponins on admission had a much higher mortality rate than those that didn't have elevated troponins. And so I'm not sure if this is like a viral myocarditis or what. They had a subset of these people that actually had ECGs done at the time of the elevated troponin. In North America, you'd probably do them on everybody, but they only had a subset of people that had ECGs, and all the ECGs did have ischemic-like abnormalities, so a little different than what we would consider receiving like a pericarditis or something like that. So I think that remains to be seen as to what actually is happening with these people. But the mortality rate on those patients with elevated troponins approached was just over 50%.
Yeah, no. That I mean, those are really useful numbers, and realizing that they are numbers as of today, and you know, these things will evolve, but we just thought it would be useful to give you some of these numbers. I'm sure some of you have heard many of these numbers, but boy, you guys sure do a good job of. I mean, you guys are just like a dog with a bone trying to find this information and put it together in a way that makes sense. And like we said at the beginning, this was a tools for practice, and we'll put this up. It's already on the web, and we'll put links to it and so on. Anything else you want to add, Mike Allen?
No, that is good. I thought it was an excellent review of the symptoms and disease progression.
Yeah. No, so great job, guys. So I think for now, we'll just leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.
So long for now.